Hello, and welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast with your hosts, Joe Lavelle and Dr. Glenn Winkle. On today's episode, number 95, we are talking with Dr. Mitchell Lee, CEO and co-founder of Aura Biomedical, about the search for small molecules and natural products that extend lifespan and delay chronic illness. Impossible, you say? Listen and learn. And just so you know, this is the first of several episodes I will present this summer as a part of my own exploration of the emerging field of geroscience and of the related field of longevity medicine, offering preventive medicine that uses biomarkers of aging to lengthen lifespan while improving health. You may have heard of rapamycin. I've been hearing about this life extension drug for a few years now, and it's caught my attention. I mean, who wouldn't be interested? All right, it didn't get my full attention because I assumed I wouldn't be able to find a doctor who would work with me on this longevity project. Plus, I assumed I would have to take a big chance on injuring myself with this experimental drug. Well, you know what they say about assumptions. If you are an older athlete like me, interested in staying strong and healthy as the years add up, as well as in recovering some functionality already lost to aging, then you should listen to this episode very intently and also to the next few episodes on the topic of longevity and health span medicine. I predict your thinking about the inevitability of quote-unquote getting old will be changed forever. In our talk, Dr. Lee provides a bit of background for the non-scientists on what progress has been made to understand what is really happening beyond the simplistic idea of accumulated damage as we accumulate years. We also talk a bit about rapamycin and what it has been shown to do in animals to extend lifespan and health span, and what it has been shown to do in people as well. Lastly, Dr. Lee explains what Aura Biomedical is doing right now to find even better interventions that we can look forward to using to help our efforts to remain strong and healthy athletes late into life. All right, let's talk to Dr. Lee of Aura Biomedical. Dr. Mitchell Lee, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Okay, well, welcome aboard. Glad to have you on today. Looking forward to what you have for us today.
All right. Dr. Lee, I am really pleased that you made some time for us. My goal today is for you to shine a light on this emerging science of aging. You know, I guess I have been hearing about it for some time, but it has just sort of become apparent to me here really recently that scientists like you have been making a ton of progress in this field. And so I'm really looking forward to you educating me. You are a scientist in the field of aging. Am I right about that?
Yeah. I have my PhD in experimental pathology from the University of Washington. I trained with Matt Kaeberlein, who's one of the world pioneers and world leading scientists in the biology of aging. Yeah. And that's really where I was introduced to aging and developed the passion for it.
Well, fantastic. I wonder if maybe you can dive a little bit deeper into, you know, your background and how you have become an expert in aging that has led you to what you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I first discovered that aging was something that you could even modify or regulate, or that there was anything beyond just entropy acting in a biological system, I was really hooked about it. But, you know, I'm from rural Oklahoma originally, and I always had the intuition in my head of, you know, a truck rusting in a field. Like, that was just what the aging process was. And it's not true. There's genetic regulation that impacts how we age. There's the environment that interacts with how we age. Stress, so many things can accelerate or decelerate the aging process. And so it's actually massively complicated. And once I learned about that as a complicated question to ask, I was really hooked. I ended up in Matt's lab at the University of Washington. There I studied two major projects. One project was asking about how fundamental drivers in cancer biology are influenced by age. And the other question was identifying new drugs that actually can impact and change the rate of aging in model systems. In Matt's lab, what we do is we model aging in simpler animals. So you can't do a test in a human. That would take decades, and there's many ethical constraints. It's hard to do things in a mouse because it's very expensive and it's slow. We're underfunded to do those kind of studies. So what we do is we model aspects of biological aging using simpler animal systems. In Matt's lab, it was things like budding yeast. and nematodes, a small little roundworm.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really great about that, and what's great about studying aging using a model system like that, is aging is something that manifests and begins at the cellular and molecular level. So at the cellular and molecular level, a worm cell is very similar to a human cell. They have the same kind of problems. They have to find nutrients, take in those nutrients, convert those into the cellular building blocks. That's an imperfect process. It generates waste, and you have to figure out how to manage that waste and get rid of it. So at that fundamental level, a worm cell and a human cell are very similar. So the same mechanisms and fundamental drivers of aging that age a worm also age a human. They just look a little bit differently.
And maybe occur over different periods of time. Well, that's really great. Sounds like I got the right guy here. So wonderful. What I'd like to learn from you today is a few things, but we've only got an hour. So, you know, let's try to keep it at a level that will keep us to that time frame.
Cool.
But let me know if you don't think that we can do it. So the first thing would be, let's understand what aging really is, just, you know, merely beyond an accumulation of years or time. I'm quite sure that there's more going on than just accumulated damage, like that rusted truck sitting in the field. And the second thing then would be, and it's really because I'm kind of late to the party here, if you could give us kind of a quick overview of the progress that's been made in aging science here, you know, recently, maybe since the discovery that rapamycin extends life. You know, I think that was like 12 or 13 years ago. And then maybe you can share with us some, what interventions are available today and where is this going? And I think that this is when, where your company, Oral Biomedical, will come into the picture here. You guys are doing things to build the future of anti-aging interventions. Do you think we can cover all of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. We can get through a bit of it, I bet.
Okay.
So if you ask any scientist what aging is, any individual scientist is likely to give you a subtly different answer.
Okay.
You know, we understand it, we know it when we see it, but actually getting down and defining it has been a fundamental challenge in the field. So when I think about aging, I think about it being the accumulation of damage as one side of it, but also the inability of the cell to resolve that damage. So there's some connection between not just what you experience as a stressor or damage, it's how well your cells can tolerate it, resolve it, and bounce back from it. So there's something about that resiliency that's also just fundamental to aging.
That's good. In fact, on my list of questions, I want to take a deep dive into that. And maybe we're not going to get the official science answer, but we'll get the Mitchell Lee official answer on what that means. But I thought we would first start with, let's talk about lifespan versus health span. I've been trying to wrap my head around this idea here that, you know, and I can see that maybe there's two variables. There's this, maybe what my genetic potential was, you know, and I had a grandma live to 106. So, you know, maybe I got some genetic potential to live long. But the second variable then would be where I am today after accumulating X number of years of impact of my environment, you know, stuff I've been eating and things I've been doing to myself and pollutants that I've been putting into my body and, you know, whatever. And so I've been trying to understand how these things kind of fit together. So my genetics maybe is the longest I would live if I did everything right from birth. And are there interventions that maybe could extend that? Or is that really just my maximum potential and all I can do is ruin it by the second thing, which is my environment, which I have come to understand that it's mostly about the environment in terms of how long people live. So what is happening with this environment? Well, and I assume that it's all bad because if, you know, my genetic potential is the maximum, then what is life doing to me that makes me die faster than that? Anyway, those are my questions, which is maybe a whole podcast all in itself. So don't spend an hour on that answer.
Sure. No. Yeah. Great question. So lifespan and health span, I kind of think about those as the difference between chronological aging and biological aging.
Okay.
So chronological aging is very easy to measure. You can measure it by looking at your driver's license. That's your date of birth and how long you've been around. Biological aging, on the other hand, has something to do with your interaction with the environment, how your genetics and environment have impacted your functional ability. You know, if we think about health span or biological age, we want to maximize that in a certain kind of way. We want to be as healthy as long as possible or mitigate biological aging as much as we can.
Yeah.
Environment absolutely can have negative consequences, you know, impact of pollution, exercise, you know, if you smoke and drink to, you know, certain degrees. Environment can also be good in certain ways too. Huh. So, you know, that your genetics don't really establish what the maximum is. Your genetics is a program that can move the needle in both directions. You know, that's what we've learned with things like caloric restriction. With caloric restriction, you're changing your environment by making your cells perceive a low nutrient condition. That actually upregulates a stress response that can increase your lifespan. You push your cells into playing a defense game, essentially.
Oh, how interesting. Okay. Well, that's very helpful. Maybe what we ought to do then is dive into what is aging. And of course, I don't mean my driver's license aging. I mean, like, what is happening? And I understand that there are what they call hallmarks of aging, which are not mutually exclusive, but comprehensive categories of things. They're kind of overlapping and related. Anyway, I should let you describe what these hallmarks are. You know, you talked about like the functional declines. And so that's sort of like how aging shows up, right? You know, my joints hurt a little more and I can't run as fast and things like that. But that's the end of the process. The beginning of the process is maybe more at the, like the molecular and the cellular level. And it's happening in millions or billions of things all of the time. And you just don't even notice. It takes a long time for that stuff to accumulate and start to have an effect on organ systems and your body's ability to repair itself and things like that. And that's when it starts to show up in my function. Am I right about how that works? Tell us about aging.
Yeah. So aging, if you think about it from a hallmarks of aging standpoint. So to take a step back, you know, aging biology has only been around and in this molecular phase for about the last 30 years. The hallmarks of aging came out as really kind of a way to provide some conceptual unity around everything that we've learned. You know, this is modeled on a paper that came out in Cancer Biology a few years before called The Hallmarks of Cancer. That really just tried to provide conceptual unity to something so massively complex as cancer. We applied that same framework into aging, and at the time we came up with about 9 different buckets essentially to put biological aging at this molecular and cellular level. You know, some of those have to do with maintaining information at the level of DNA. So DNA damage, epigenetic changes, changes at the level of a telomere is one kind of general category. Other things related to dysregulated nutrient signaling is another one. Things related to how well you maintain the protein environment. So if you can maintain proteins and keep them folded properly, so changes or disruptions in proteostasis is one, and numerous others. But you're absolutely right. These are ways to categorize and get at the molecular level changes that actually are the initiators of the aging process. And, you know, they did this paper about 10 years ago. They just put out another one just about less than a year ago where they've increased that number to 12. You know, the great thing as a scientist about the hallmarks of aging is that it does. It provides this conceptual unity to a very messy and heterogeneous field. At the same time, it had an unintended consequence of kind of limiting our imagination in some kind of ways as scientists. So instead of, you know, if I try to write a grant to get, you know, funding to go study something, if I talk about aging, but I don't couch my grant in some hallmark of aging, it's harder to get it funded because we've got this conceptual unity that's kind of created almost a fence. We've almost fenced ourselves in conceptually in how we engage. It's limiting our ability to discover in some kind of capacities.
Oh, interesting. So it's sort of like if you're talking about going to understand a hallmark, then it's sort of like an understood
disease that you're trying to understand better. But if you're going after something that's not in that set of categories, then you're fishing for stuff, and people don't like to fund fishing expeditions.
Yeah. I don't understand that. You know, going on a fishing expedition is only a bad thing if you don't intend to catch fish.
Right. Okay. Well, I think when we hear more about what your company is doing, we're going to hear a lot about how to catch a lot of fish. All right. So this aging thing is just to make sure that I have sort of got the picture in my head. Tell me if I'm close, at least. When we're in a development mode, maybe, and I don't know what that is, up to you're 23 years old or something, you know, your body is in this growth and development phase, and we're all familiar with that. It's been a long time for me, but I still remember, and I see it happening with my children. But you then get to this transition where you stop developing, you stop growing, you know, you stop getting taller and that sort of thing. And maybe your genetics are sort of like at the end of their rope on that, because you now can reproduce, and that's kind of where a lot of the testing from an evolutionary perspective came into it. And so you're just sort of hanging on and trying to maintain, and these mechanisms of doing this maintenance are benefited or hurt by the environment you put them under. If you are not exercising and you are eating too much and not getting good sleep and you have a lot of stress in your life, you know, et cetera, then maybe you're accelerating the aging. Your body's ability to repair itself is being hurt. And so you're not repairing yourself well, and you're starting to accumulate problems that then will compound. Anyway, this is the accelerated aging. And on the other hand, when you're doing the good lifestyle stuff, you're getting enough exercise, but not too much, and you're getting good sleep, and you're eating nutritious foods, and you have periods of feasting and periods of famine, so that your body is getting growth signals followed by scavenge the damaged stuff, clearing a lot of that damaged stuff out, you're getting some kind of benefit from that from an aging perspective. But all of that molecular, cellular things start to roll up into organ systems, and then you start to have wrinkled skin and gray hair and painful joints, and you can't run as fast. Your VO2 max maybe is falling, and when you go to the doctor and you get a blood test, they're looking at things like your blood pressure maybe is going up, or your blood sugar is starting to get too high, or your cholesterol is piling up in your arteries, and your kidney function isn't working as well. And this is sort of these functional markers that we have that we could use to estimate this biological aging. Then you could compare that to your chronological age in years, and you could figure out, are you aging slower or faster?
Yeah, I'd say two things there. So one, you're absolutely right. Thinking about the things that end up driving aging, it seems like aging, it doesn't begin necessarily at the start of your life. It seems like you're developing, growing, you kind of, you know, maybe reach a functional maximum, and then that starts to decline with time.
Yeah.
How that is impacted and has been influenced by evolutionary forces is absolutely fascinating. If you ask me kind of what drives or establishes aging, I'm more into that camp about evolutionary drivers. So evolution and natural selection, it cares a lot about maintaining organism function and ability up until you reproduce. And then you've reproduced and it's the next generation, and you have to get that next generation to reproductive ability so they can pass on the genetic material. Beyond that point of passing on the genetic material, it's not clear what mechanisms evolution has to maintain biological function.
Yeah.
So we're kind of in the shadow of this selection that has geared us towards reproducing and being healthy up until that point. And a lot of people, they even say that mechanisms like growth signaling, you know, growth signaling and nutrient signaling, it says there's nutrients, start growing, start dividing your cells and develop. Major influencer in development. A lot of people think that that level of growth signaling just maintains through time even though it's not really necessary because we're not developing any longer. And that can lead to things like cancer, because too much growth, too much cell division can end up kicking off things like carcinogenesis. So a lot of people actually think that evolution and the things that have evolutionarily got us to a reproductive stage optimally are actually the things that end up driving our aging in later days. So that's one thing I'd say. On the other side of it, you're again, 100% correct, thinking about biomarkers. So this difference between chronological age and biological age, you know, as I said, chronological age is very easy to measure. Biological age is incredibly difficult to measure. We are still figuring out and struggling how we think about measuring functional decline at that molecular and cellular level in a way that's consistent and can be actualized. One of the things that's very hot right now are epigenetic tests. So great researchers, very smart people in the field, they have started looking at epigenetic changes, which an epigenetic change, you've got your genetic material, then you've got some little chemical changes that go on top of that genetic material that influence how it gets expressed, how you turn up and down and on and off genes.
Right.
So those little changes change with age also. And if you look at enough of those features all together, it seems like they correlate with age in a certain kind of way. So there's a lot of people talking about they can calculate your biological age by using those epigenetic profiles. And we just really don't know yet what that means.
Right.
You know, this is a collection of features that it's not clear how it's related to physiology, health, or aging. There's a correlation there, but there are correlations between all kinds of things that don't mean anything. So we're still figuring out exactly how to functionalize those measures, how to figure out the best ways to estimate biological aging. And that's one of the things that we've had good advances in the field around. Everybody appreciates it as a major standing issue. And once we get to the point of developing those kind of methods, that will be one great step forward in terms of us being able to treat and think about changing aging.
Oh, it sure seems like if you had that would make a big difference in being able to prove when things were, you know, interventions were helping.
Yep.
Because, you know, if you have to wait until people actually die, that could take a very long time. But if you could just do a blood test or whatever and have a formula that was reliable, and then you could just 6 months later, after some intervention, see that the blood tests are improving in the right direction, it's working.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. And, you know, we're getting more developed in terms of how we engage that, but other kinds of standard blood chemistry and, you know, going to your doctor and maintaining that, thinking about those things, getting those functional measurements taken, you know, that's not nothing.
Yeah.
That is good to look at. And, you know, that's what I always recommend. You know, some people ask me, what do I advise? You know, what would I recommend somebody to do to maximize their health span or lifespan? I wish I knew a secret, but I don't. You know, best thing you can do, you know, exercise. Don't, you know, try to be a kid as much as possible. You know, go out, run, have fun, you know, manage your stress, read a book that challenges you, but also have a good relationship with a physician. You know, don't ignore your routine blood work, you know, engage in those tests, you know, start to measure those biological variables.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of things we don't know about changing aging, but we've been studying aging in humans from a clinical perspective for a while. And we know at least when things start to change.
Yeah. And I'll just add on to that. What I believe anyway is that maybe we don't understand how all of the different things, you know, high blood sugar and heart disease and kidney problems and gut microbiome, maybe we don't understand exactly how they're all interconnected, but we've got a lot of medical science behind us in having to, you know, resolving things. When your blood pressure is too high, there's medications you can take to get your blood pressure down, and you should do that, you know, and not just try to live with higher blood pressure because that's going to end up bad for you. But these aging intervention things are maybe more fundamental things that maybe would have broad-reaching effects on across blood pressure and heart disease and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah. The therapeutics that we have today, oh, they're great. They're medical breakthroughs. Don't eschew those. You know, take those if you need them. But at the end of the day, those are really getting at treating symptoms and downstream impacts of a disease or the impacts of chronic illness. Mm-hmm. These interventions that target the mechanisms that drive aging are getting at that root cause. You know, we don't necessarily know what aging is in terms of giving it a definition, but the connection between aging and it being the central greatest driver of the chronic illnesses and diseases that limit our lifespan is absolutely clear.
Yeah.
The largest drivers of cancer, heart disease, neurodegenerative disease, metabolic dysfunction, aging, that is the central root cause of so many of these things. So aged longevity medicine or age targeting interventions get at that root instead of treating the downstream symptoms. You know, it's a revolutionary idea in healthcare. You know, instead of going after the symptoms, instead of going to your doctor sick and mitigating that illness, actually trying to be as preventative as possible and figure out the ways to engage and get at the root of actually what drives those disease states.
Yeah. And some of it is lifestyle stuff, which we know a lot about and we should pursue. And the people who are listening here with us today, I think, largely are doing that. You know, they exercise and they try to eat healthy and they maybe through their exercise, they're trying to manage stress and all of those other things. But maybe there are other things, pharmaceutical type of interventions that can help. Let's talk about how we know about some of these pharmaceutical interventions. Tell us about the National Institute for Aging. What does it do? And has it found anything useful? I think I know the answer.
Excellent. Well, so if you think about any scientific paper you've ever read, any study that you've heard on the news, the major funder allowing that research to happen is the National Institutes of Health. It's the U.S. government's branch of biomedical research. It's how we fund 90% of the research that happens in the United States.
The NIH.
Yep. And the NIH is broken into different subgroups and sub-branches. One of those is the National Institute of Aging, and that is the largest funder of aging biomedical research probably on the planet right now. And so in terms of what they've found, just like what I said, if you've ever heard any study on aging, thank the federal government. Thank the NIH for that. The NIA helped make that happen.
Right.
A couple of them that I'm very excited about, one of them is the Dog Aging Project. So the Dog Aging Project is a nationwide enrollment study for companion pets, the dogs that we love, who live in our environments and share so much of our lives with us. You can enroll your pet dog in the Dog Aging Project. One part of it is just a longitudinal study. They just want to monitor your pet through time, better understand how it ages, the onset of age-associated diseases in dogs. We've been doing veterinary medicine for well over a century, but veterinary gerontology is actually, there's still a lot to learn. And so this is going to be one thing that gets us towards that.
That's interesting. And so that would be better than a mouse study of mice living in cages where they're not exposed to the real world. These are dogs that are living out in the real world, and maybe even better than that, because they're sort of living in the human world, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, they share our environment. A lot of them share the same food with us. We know dogs as social animals. You can see their stress levels. So many people see themselves in their dogs, and they see humans in their dogs, and that's not an accident. Huh. Yeah, that really is true. So, and they're a large mammal, and so little research has been done in large mammals, just in part because it takes a very long time and those are very hard studies. The Dog Aging Project is doing that. A subset of that overall program is called the Triad Trial. It's the test of rapamycin in aging dogs. And so they're enrolling a subset of animals in the Dog Aging Project cohort, or the pack is what they call it. Some of those animals are going to be in a controlled study testing rapamycin. And so they're enrolling for it now. It's going to be 1 year of rapamycin treatment and 2 years of follow-up. And within 3 to 5 years, we're going to see the results of that. We're going to, for the first time, understand how the best-in-class longevity therapeutic works in a large mammal. And coming out of Matt Kaeberlein's lab, he's one of the individuals who made the first connections between TOR signaling, which is what rapamycin impacts in aging. I've seen it time and time again impact and improve lifespan and health span in just about every organism we've looked at. So I'm very bullish on it. I think in the next 3 to 5 years is the next watershed moment in longevity medicine where we see this proof of principle study for the first time. And that is going to change our mentality. That's going to show us what's possible. And then we're going to have to figure out what's the best.
And so that's a study of rapamycin?
It is, yeah.
Okay. So I guess they do a handful of chemicals every year, and they've been doing it since like 2009 or something like that. So, you know, what are we talking about? You know, like 150 things that have been studied?
Yeah, so the dog aging project is one of the major projects I'm excited about that's funded by the NIA. The other one is called the Interventions Testing Program.
Ah.
The Interventions Testing Program, or ITP, has been around since 2004, and it's a multi-site experiment where they test longevity compounds in mice. It's a heterogeneous mice background, so that means they're all genetically a little bit different. You know, so that's a little bit better than studying things in an inbred model, and it's testing in a multi-site way. So they have tested to date about 65 interventions. 3 of those improve lifespan in both sexes, and another 5 work in one sex or another.
Oh, how interesting.
That's something that's really fascinating to me is, you know, these interventions are not going to be magic bullets. They're not going to work across the board for every single individual. Some are going to have sex-specific efficacy. Some of them are going to depend on natural genetic variation, others on your environment. You know, there's no easy answer right now in terms of what intervention you should test or take, because we just don't know.
Awesome. But this is legit science. It's not marketing. It's not somebody trying to sell some nutritional supplement that isn't really going to do me any good. These are real things. Now it's in mice, so we you know, we have to have some faith that there is some connection between what happens in a mouse is going to be related to what happens in a human being. But these are real findings. So rapamycin is one. Is that like the best one that they have found? You know, what else have they found?
Yeah, that's currently the best in class. That one has the most robust and translational results. When I say that, it means that it has the biggest impacts in terms of improving lifespan and function and even mitigating a lot of disease states. Even diseases that you wouldn't think are strongly age-driven seem to be improved by rapamycin. And it's the most translatable, which that means that it works in a yeast, it works in a worm, it works in a mouse, it works in a fly. Every organism we've tested it in, we've seen benefits from.
Huh.
So it really gives us a lot of hope, especially if these fundamental drivers of aging are evolutionarily conserved in this way. By finding a drug that works across vast evolutionary distance, the hope and the idea is that it will translate into large mammals.
Okay, well, that's great. I have heard that for rapamycin, which is the best one found so far, that it has been tested in certain limited ways in human beings and have found that similar to the effects in the small mammals, the human beings also get like immune system benefits and periodontal disease type benefits and cardiovascular muscle benefits and things like that. Can you tell us a little more about what are these benefits that have been seen in humans?
Sure. In the human studies, there's been a clinical trial. So backing up just one step, rapamycin is an FDA-approved compound. It's been given to humans for quite a while. It's been given to individuals in the context of organ transplantations. So that's if you take very high doses of this compound, it seems to modulate or suppress your immune system in a way that makes you better able to tolerate an organ transplant.
Not reject it.
It's also an approved therapeutic for different kinds of cancers. Lately, in the last handful of years, We've tested it, like you said, in the context of immune system. So this is kind of where it's so complicated getting into rapamycin and TOR signaling, because a little bit will do one thing, a lot will do the opposite thing. So a little bit of rapamycin we've seen in individuals, I think it was 65 and older, if you give that to them and then give them a vaccine, they actually have a stronger immune response. They get better benefits out of the vaccine, and they're able to fight against infection better. That's one of the key human results in dogs.
So,
oh, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Just to clarify, in some uses of rapamycin, it suppresses the immune system, and in other uses, it boosts the immune system. That's a bit confusing.
It is. Some of that is dose dependent. In the case of an organ transplant, they take very, very high doses of rapamycin. In these other cases, these clinical trials we've seen where it improves immune function, it's a much lower dose.
Okay.
The other caveat of that is that the immune system is very complex. You know, I'm a biologist of aging, but immunology is above my pay grade.
Wow.
You know, it's a very different system. There's different flavors of immunity. There's adaptive and innate immunity.
So it's complicated all by itself, and lots of layers. And so, you know, you're turning this on or that off. And okay, all right. Well, not that I understand it, but at least I get a feel for the complexity of it.
You're in good company.
All right. Well, so where I wanted to go with this, you said that they had found three things that applied to both sexes, and then a handful of others that didn't apply to both sexes, but that did have some sort of lifespan improvement. And I have also heard that through that program and then other things that scientists have done, there's been like maybe 1,500, tell me if that's crazy wrong, but only about 1,500 chemicals have been studied in like the last 10 years. For looking for interventions that might have lifespan, health span type benefits. And as a person who has got a kind of a limited window here in getting an intervention beyond what I can just do by lifestyle, I'm kind of in a hurry. And so how can we go faster to find more things? I mean, if rapamycin, something that we found laying in the dirt of Easter Island 30 years ago, is still the best thing that we have found? I mean, is that really going to be the very best thing, or have we not looked hard enough?
Yeah, I don't think we've looked hard enough at all. So, the largest publicly available data set that catalogs longevity interventions has a little under 1,100 interventions in them currently. If you scrub all of the literature, all of the screens that have been done, that number might go up as high as 100,000. 90% of those interventions, you know, we don't have that data. We don't know the quality of that data. We don't know how many animals were tested. So there's a huge asterisk over that number. But we are only scratching the surface in terms of investigating and understanding chemical space and what actually improves lifespan. So one of the big challenges in the field is how to accelerate that. You know, how do we go from testing 100,000 interventions or 1,000 interventions to 1,000,000. You know, a given study, if you're a grad student, you know, doing your PhD work, you might investigate 5 to 10 compounds in the period of 5 years. How do we do 1,000,000 in 2 years? You know, how do we get to the point where we're really combing through chemical space?
Yeah.
And that's one thing, just finding the single interventions. You know, finding dual things, finding things that combine and synergize with each other is all the way in the pioneering space of the field. If you look at some of the prominent journals and some of the interventions that they found over the last handful of years, they've reported on, you know, a few different combination interventions. So this is on the cutting edge of the science. It's just pairwise combinations with things we've known for decades.
I see.
Why it's gone so slow, a bit of that is funding limitations. You know, as we were saying, you know, the NIH and the NIA are major funders of federal research. They fund, you know, a lot of federal research, and a lot of my friends, a lot of people, you know, as I was writing grants, 90% of grants don't succeed. They don't get funded. And that's not because the science is bad. It's because we don't have the resources. If you wanted to accelerate and revolutionize biomedical science, all you need to do is add resources into the system, because there is a ton of amazing breakthrough science that's left on the cutting room floor just because there's not enough money to go around.
Well, tell us about Aura Biomedical, your company. You guys are trying to deal with this question of how to cover more ground. If you're a graduate student and you can test five things, you know, as a part of getting your PhD, well, you're going to pick things that you're pretty sure are going to work, right? I mean, you can't really go off the reservation. But if you can test a million things, you can afford to have some failures in there.
Absolutely.
And maybe by being able to take a chance, you're going to find great stuff. Tell us about what you guys are doing.
Absolutely. So at Aura Biomedical, we're a pharmaceutical company that identifies and develops small molecule interventions that target the mechanisms that drive aging, and they broadly fight disease and extend our healthy lifespan. The way how we do that is with a combined robotics and AI system that allows us to do massive high throughput drug screening. Huh. So we use a small animal system called C. elegans. It's a little nematode, and we can test thousands of populations in tandem. You know, as we're growing up and expanding our capacity, our goal is in the next 2.5 years, screening 1 million interventions. Wow. And so we can screen, you know, FDA approved compounds, which, you know, things like rapamycin is an FDA approved compound. If we found new uses for it, ways that it could be utilized for aging and longevity, we know the safety profiles of it. We know humans tolerate it well. So that provides you an expedited pathway to actually getting it to people who need it. Hmm. So going after things that have known safety profiles is really the quickest way to have the best impact on people in the near future. Hmm. There are other things like natural products that you can investigate. Those, you know, they have a mixed reputation. You know, you can go to supplement shelves and hear all these different claims. With us, we want to feed into those kind of direct-to-consumer pathways with the highest scientific quality, the best nutraceuticals, the best things that we know work. So, you know, it's not because natural products are bad or they don't work. It's because the science is a variable quality that gets those to the shelf. And then the frontier is just investigating chemical space broadly. You know, there is, you know, millions and millions of molecules that can be studied. How do we find those things? And you're absolutely right. The field as it is really hedges its bets. You know, if I'm a grad student, I want to do something that'll get me to a paper. If I'm a PI, I need to be able to write a grant. You know, you can take the big swing. You can try to find something brand new. But in so many cases, you go for the conservative approach. The thing that you already know works, applied in a slightly different way, an incremental advance, you know, that gets papers out, that gets people grants, but it doesn't get us to next level discovery. And that's what we're going to do at Aura Biomedical.
Wow, that's great. And what would be the timeline? I'm sure that this is something that you guys would understand better, but it always seems to me as a layperson that drugs take forever to come out, and I'm in a hurry. So what do you think?
Absolutely. You know, we've just launched our operations. We opened up our independent facility a couple of months ago. We've already identified novel interventions that increase lifespan.
Wow.
Some of those are FDA approved. So then the thing is to figure out the pathways to be able to get those into clinical trials as quickly as possible to get those into use for humans. Now, if we're thinking about just longevity therapeutics, there's another challenge there. So the FDA, the regulator of pharmaceuticals, it's hard to figure out how you get a longevity intervention to go through those clinical trials. So they're not against targeting aging, but they want indications. They want endpoints. And so often what you do is you aim at a disease state or improving symptoms associated with a disease state. So we're figuring out as a field of geroscience and as a field of developing health span interventions, how we actually navigate the regulatory structure of the FDA. You know, some people are doing that on the companion pet side. Nobody's really doing that all that much on the human side. And that's a continued conversation that's being had with regulators and with scientists today to figure out, even if we have that blockbuster, how can we make it available to people for the use in aging in particular?
That's great. I understand that we only discovered that rapamycin could be taken late in life by accident. And so when you and people like yourself are doing these kinds of studies, are they looking for things that can be applied to the older person and still get the benefit? Or is it, are we going to have to get lucky again to discover something like that?
That's a great question. Yeah. So when I first got into the field, a lot of people weren't asking about interventions. They weren't asking about small molecules. There wasn't an interest in it because if you tried to submit a grant for it, you wouldn't get it funded. So there was a push away from it. And then the other side, the people who were in favor of intervention said that, well, you have to take them very early to get the benefit from it. So yeah, this serendipitous discovery that you could actually take rapamycin late in life and resolve benefits, it's both robust and it's been shown in multiple labs across the country. Hmm. So figuring out those protocols and how to aim at late life interventions is something that we need broad scale efforts for. You know, with our system at Aura Biomedical, we can time our dosages and we can think about how to do those things and give those to later stage animals to find those things that would have the best benefit even in late adulthood.
Oh, that's great. Let me just say thanks for that. Although, you know, I would like my children to live long too, and so it's all good, but, you know, my window is shrinking. Okay, we're going to run out of time here, Dr. Lee, and so I want to start to wrap up. And let me just say that the audience listening here is the older athlete. And so these are people in a hurry to combat aging, if it's possible. They are already doing what they can from a lifestyle perspective. And so I assume that they, like me, are interested in what else can be done. And so we're talking about pharmaceuticals or nutraceuticals or, you know, natural products that perhaps could be used. Can you tell us what is known now? You know, I understand that there's going to be some new information coming out soon and more, I think, over time. But what do we know now? Rapamycin, we've spoken about. Is there anything else like a carbose or metformin or, you know, these other things that people know about?
Yeah, I wish I could, you know, I wish I knew the secret. I wish I could say, go do this. It's going to help, you know, everybody take this. You know, honestly, we're just not there yet. We have to figure it out. We're on the cusp of figuring it out. And there are more clinicians who are engaging in this space. So if you are interested in understanding how interventions might be able to work for you, what you should do is go talk to a clinician.
Yeah.
And there are more longevity medicine affiliated and aware clinicians than ever before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, go look around, go look in that space and talk to a few different people, see what they're giving individuals. See how they measure things. You know, at the end of the day, it is going to come down to individual responses. Not everything is going to be great for everybody.
Sure. And there are side effects. I assume that the doctors can help you to sort of monitor what the effects are having on you, and maybe they're negative and you should stop doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, don't just grab everything you can. You know, I've heard of some people in the space, you know, there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of over-exuberance. And I'll talk to individuals and they're like, I love it. Here's my stack. And then they'll give you a laundry list of every natural product that's ever had a paper associated with it. And it's like, no, that's not the way to go. Like, I don't know what the right answer is, but I can almost guarantee you that's the wrong answer.
Yeah.
So at the very least, talk to your clinicians, you know, work out a good relationship. Find those people who understand what this field is like. And, you know, it's surprising that so few clinicians really think about the biology of aging and geroscience. So you really do need to find those clinicians who are aware of these breakthroughs that have been happening over the last 10 to 15 years.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that's great advice. I just have one more question, and then I'll ask you if there's anything that I didn't think to ask you about, and then you can tell us how we can follow along with Aura Biomedical. The question is this. And I don't know how bold you'll want to be, but be bold. How much of a benefit do you think we can get from these interventions? You know, on top of exercising and eating healthy and getting good sleep and managing stress and those and not smoking and, you know, et cetera. How much of a benefit do you think we could get? I mean, I think worms and mice get a pretty good benefit out of some of these interventions even started late in their lives, at least on the mice. What do you think a person might be able to think is possible?
I'll answer that two ways. So one thing, thinking about it on the health span side, there is so much room for improvement. You know, right now, chronic illness and disease begin to manifest in our 50s, 60s. You know, if you look at the natural human lifespan as we understand it today, that's about the midway point. You know, I think that we are sensitized to age-related dysfunction. And so in terms of these interventions and how they can improve the quality of our lifespan, I think there's so much room to be improved. I think we're going to see massive benefits in that. The other question is, well, what about maximum lifespan? How long can we go? That, you know, you'll get a lot of different people in the field. You'll get futurists who say that we're on the cusp of immortality. That's a faith-based assertion. It's not a science-based assertion. So I am a scientist, but I'm hopeful. I think, you know, a maximum human lifespan of 150 is absolutely not out of the question. And that's not, that's a healthy, vibrant, active, cognitively firing on all cylinders lifespan.
That would be amazing.
You know, a lot of people, they say, well, I don't want to live that long if it means, you know, I'm in X or Y condition. It's like, well, yeah, nobody does. Yeah. So like, we're all aiming at improving health span. And, you know, we're going to see what maximum lifespan does as we improve health span across the board.
Yeah. Well, health span is certainly the place to start, and maybe some more benefits will come. I've heard it said that nobody wants to live to 120 and feel like they're 120 years old. Tell us about how we can find more information about this science and how it progresses, and follow Aura Biomedical's progress in its effort to find more solutions.
Absolutely. So Aura Biomedical, you can find us online. Please visit the website. You can see what we're up to. For real-time updates, we do a lot of posting on social media like Twitter, LinkedIn. I'm also on LinkedIn and Twitter. Our board chair, Matt Caberline, is on there as well. He is a prominent, active voice in the field.
Yeah.
And outreach and communication and educating the public, you know, getting people excited about what we do. We all recognize that as a central feature that we have to do. It's not enough to do incredible science in a vacuum. You've got to take that out and show people and tell people and get people excited about it. That's what we've just started to do. So just a few days ago, we started promoting some of the first interventions that we've identified. You'll be seeing, you know, every week, every few days, the latest results coming out of Aura Biomedical showing what we can do.
Fantastic.
And, you know, it's really exciting. We, you know, we've just gotten started. We're already finding really impressive therapeutics. And there's just, you know, nowhere to go but up.
Awesome. Dr. Lee, thank you very much. This has been really educational. And since you told me this was the first podcast you ever did, I want to tell you, you're a pro. You're a natural.
Thank you all so much. It's been great to sit down and chat with you.
Yeah, it's been a blast. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much for listening in to our discussion with Dr. Mitchell Lee, CEO of Aura Biomedical, about the emerging science and the Million Molecule Moonshot Project to rapidly advance longevity intervention discovery. You can find more information about Dr. Lee and Aura Biomedical in the show notes.